I'll bet nobody slept through that first half, Tomás.
I don't think so.
Have you any breath left?
A little bit from the windy mountaintop. But I'll tell you, I wasn't actually really thinking about breathlessness. I was having a long consideration of indeterminacy.
Indeterminacy? Where, how have you got from night on a bare mountain to indeterminacy now?
Well, I'm glad you asked me. It's about that word bare. We're into Jacques Derrida, old Jack, and the variable nature of words and how we come to fill words with meaning from our own content, from our own history. And, you know, I have a very strange relationship with Mussorgsky.
Would you care to stop there?
I could be pushed to stop, or I could be pushed to go on and tell you this. So what happened was, I grew up, obviously, in like many people in Dublin, in my plus fours, with my ruffled collar, in the snow, with my favourite sledge, waiting for the station master to come from the station through the forest, sliding along the snow and bring us the great news each morning.
I'm getting a strong visual, Tomás.
Yeah, very, very strong visual. Typical 1970s Dublin upbringing. That is to say, obviously, I lived entirely in my imagination. and my imagination was completely clouded by Dr. Zhivago, as clearly were a lot of people in the 1970s and 80s in this country. You have nightclubs, Zhivago's nightclub. You had record shops, Zhivago's record. Zhivago was everywhere. So I'm living this kind of life. And to me, when I was listening to this music, and it was occasionally you would hear this, because in those days now, for the young people listening, in those days, you couldn't actually hear this music on a regular basis. We only had the one channel. And so finding music was very tricky. So a lot of it existed only in your memory. Because even if you went into the record shops, go into a record shop. Record shops in those days, vinyl records. Now, everyone is hugely into it now, big revival in vinyl. But they were big and bulky. So the record shops were pretty useless. They had minuscule stock. Minuscule.
We're talking about indeterminacy here, are we, Tomás?
Oh, hold on. You hold on. So there I was, and I could never get hold of this record that I loved, A Night on Bear Mountain.
We're back.
Exactly. So I never saw it written down. And so for me, it's B-E-A-R, Bear Mountain.
Oh, you're thinking of grizzly bears?
Grizzly bears. And so this is a stomping romp with bears rushing from the forest at this mountain. It's a mountain filled with bears, not witches at all.
Oh,
and that's how I completely saw it in my mind. And, and again, I was there tonight. This is bears. It's all about bears. And I'm not thinking about poems, and I'm not thinking about bald. Bear, meaning bald, which is what apparently the translation was all about. I was thinking about bear, meaning B-A-R-S.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, so frighteningly, I actually didn't get that until I landed into Leningrad in the Soviet Union. Now, St. Petersburg is a beautiful city of, fabulous Rococo buildings and charm, but Leningrad, when I landed in Leningrad, it was a city of concrete.
There wasn't a sign up saying Leningrad welcomes to Moscow Council or anything like that.
I'm looking back now and I can't remember at all. No, there wasn't now that I think about it. So we found ourselves in a big concrete mausoleum of music. And I was astounded because it was a record shop like nothing I'd ever seen before. It was like the size of Cleary's. And it was filled with records. And I made my way over to the rip-off section. And they didn't believe too much in copyright. And they were paying lip service to it. And they had all these ripped-off records by the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and everything. And in there was a fan. I was a fan of a fellow called Tomita, Isio Tomita, or it could be Tomita. And he had produced an electronic music album of Stravinsky's The Firebird. I flipped it over, was delighted. It was, a couple of kopecks. I don't know what that was, but you gave them a small piece of string and they gave you this back. Flipped it over and there
colored
was
beads,
a night, a small coloured bead, A Night on Bear Mountain, B-A-R-E. The scales fell from my eyes. I never was able to listen to that music properly again.
And initially you probably thought it was a mistake.
I knew it was a mistake.
Yeah, had to be.
Over time, I realised that I had erred in this. But it didn't make any difference to me in the music, and now I'm still there with my bears.
But it struck me as well, Tomás, listening to you there, that if you think about it, if it's B-A-R or B-A-R-E, equally can be applied. They can be applied equally almost to the type of music we have here. I thought it was a fantastic piece.
That's a great piece.
I often worry about when you see in a program, you know, a sort of a 10-minute piece. Mm. Now, last week we had Tam O'Shanter from Malcolm Arnold. Didn't do it for me at all. So you think of these sort of filler pieces there. This is no filler piece. That's the great thing about it. It's absolutely fantastic. Really great. That's why I said, do you have any breath left, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is, you know, I agree. But the minute I saw a little 10-minute piece like that, I just tipped my hat to, you know, the hippies. Oh. And I thought, you know, without them, we would not have Mussorgsky. I mean, Mussorgsky exists because of the hippies.
I don't get that. Yes, we'll come back. We'll come back to that.
I was putting that out as a challenge for you. But what was going on was Disney had released Fantasia, that Night on Bear Mountain is in the middle of it, and it became an underground hit.
Really?
Because people were going in, they were taking LSD and watching this visual trip on the screen with this music. Mussorgsky sales, you know, they rocketed by people taking, you know, who wanted this soundtrack to small, short LSD-inspired trips. And, you know, this is the same with a lot of his music. And that's how he ended up really being part of the electronic underground music scene in the 1970s that was of interest to me.
Well, it's interesting to us that, you know, that's one of those, it's a great piece. It's if you look at his life, it's pretty sad. He died fairly early, he had trouble with the drink. But also, even before he got the trouble with the drink, he had terrible trouble with procrastination. He would start something, he'd work on something, he would complete it, he'd go back, he'd rework it. And as a consequence, there isn't a huge body of work there from him. But the pieces that are well-known and popular are also very highly regarded, such as this, such as, for instance, Pictures at an Exhibition. Did I ever tell you, I went to Vienna once, there was a performance of that by Lang Lang and the Vienna Phil in the Musikverein there. Now, the Musikverein is one of the great halls of the world, Tomas. You know, the first time I went there, it was for, what was it? It was Verdi's Requiem. I remember noting at the time, I said, it's real fur and lots of gold leaf. No messing, you know. But even at that, and I'm sure the seats up the front are very expensive. They always have a few down the back for people who just walk up and pay, you know, I don't know what they pay now, maybe €10 or something like that. So there's a great accessibility to classical music in Vienna. Another thing I loved about it was a Sunday morning, Tomas. This is a prime concert at 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning. I would love if we had that here, because you could see all the good burgers there in their proper suits and the rest of it. And they were all heading off to their lunch afterwards, which I did. Dart around. You know, the stage door of the Musikverein, or the back entrance to the Imperial Hotel, are literally opposite one another. So an awful lot of the artists stay there and they just literally scoot across the road and in.
A bit like the back door of the Gaiety being near Neary's.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right, Tomas. It is very similar. Not quite as close as the Neary's and the Gaiety stage door. But of course, you've reminded me of, who was the actor there? I think he died recently. And he was in the middle of a performance in the Gaiety. And he wasn't getting the necessary response and feedback from the audience. And he turned around, basically, as a sod the lot he is, and he headed off. And he was found later in Neary's having a couple of pints. It was great.
Well, I'm glad we didn't find the name of that actor from a legal perspective.
Sibelius. I'm thinking of one of the great violin concertos here. And we're being spoiled, Tomas, because what was it last week? We had Mendelssohn. Now we've got Sibelius. A fantastic piece, most particularly for if you've got a virtuoso player, this gives them such an opportunity to show off if they want. I mean, and there are huge technical demands here as well. I remember once seeing a performance by Vengorov, the fantastic Russian violinist. I'd have to say, of all the people I've heard live, I heard him here in Dublin. I've got to tell you this story, Tomas. I heard him here in Dublin, here in the concert hall. And I'd been at a weekend, you know, on these wine weekends down the west, Delphi Lodge. Remember Delphi Lodge?
I do.
Fantastic. They had a wine weekend down there featuring the wines of Domaine de la Romane Conti. Magnificent stuff. We had a big tasting in the morning, Saturday morning, tasted through the range. No shortage of wine at the dinner that night and the Saturday night. So you can imagine I wasn't the sharpest knife in the box on Sunday morning. Long drive home, get home late afternoon. And of course, Fiona says, concert tonight. Now, I'm never a good man for going out on a Sunday night anyway. I said, no, come on, right. And I was not enthusiastic. I wanted to read the Sunday papers, blah, blah, blah. Went along. Now, it's a hoary old cliche, the old edge of the seat, but this was edge of the seat stuff. I said, my God. It was like some sort of wizardry or sorcery that he was able to extract this sound out of the violin, you know? And then, of course, he was playing around a bit at the end with an encore. And this was then far. I was expected to see, you know, electric sparks coming off the violin. He was doing some Brahms Hungarian Dances, I think, which are fairly lively anyway, but my God, he played them at quadruple speed. And as we were leaving then, just going out of the auditorium, I found somebody outside. He'd left in a sort of a moral high ground huff outside because he said, oh, that's not what he's, you know, sort of denigrating his talent, blah, blah, blah. I got chatting to him about this, you see. And I couldn't believe it. He was ruining the performance for me. I was on a high. It was Romane Conti wine. It was Romane Conti playing. And this fellow was huffing and puffing. And I just turned and said, oh, for God's sake. And I walked off like this. I've never spoken to him since. It was just over there to us. You see up there on the balcony beside the chandelier. And do you know something? They have yet to put a plaque there.
No plaque for your glorious defence.
No.
No. You said Romane Conti performance, but I think that's, again, you know, that's what we're looking at this week and last week. These are Romane Conti performances. These are, you know, Romane Conti, the finest wine in the world, invented only for princes, invented only for the aristocracy in France. You couldn't buy it unless you were a personal friend of, you know, the Count of Conti. Of course, the other thing about Romane Conti is that it's massively expensive and that you can't experience it unless you are in Delphi Lodge and you have £5,000 to spend on a bottle.
£5,000.
or somebody's offering you a half tincture of wine.
I had a half thimble.
Yes, exactly. But so you can't really experience it except in those contexts. Whereas here we are now, for a very reasonable price. We don't want to do an advert for pricing here. But for a very reasonable price, concert goers can experience this kind of, you know, exuberance, exoticism and perfection. I used to only know a musical piece by, you know, the one thing, invariably something to do with Deutsche Grammophon and invariably something to do with himself. But now, you know, you can experience it. So you can have different variations of performance, and then you can assess them one against the other. I think in some ways it's becoming even more difficult for violinists and virtuosos to perform because they're right up against each other, and the contrasts and the comparisons are there for people at the click of a button.
It's funny you should say that to us, because it also raises another issue with regard to live performance. Recording technology has moved on so much now that there's this almost perfection there. A piece can be polished and polished and polished until it is, inverted commas, perfect. Concert goers who've listened to that, a slightly sanitised version, it has to be said, then come into a hall. And some of them go away with a litany of, oh, did you hear the bum note? This sort of thing. Or did you, what about the, and the phrasing here was, we've got this sort of chasing after perfection, which is all very fine and perhaps can be achieved in the recording studio, albeit in a sanitised version. And to compare that then with the live performance, I think is probably all wrong.
Well, I think, you see, you've hit the nail on the head for me, and I suppose that's what I was struggling to say, but you've said it more elegantly in relation to YouTube. I'm constantly thinking about Glenn Gould withdrawing from the live performance to create the perfection of the actual, you know, of the recorded performance.
Yeah.
And you see, the beauty of a performance tonight is that you're getting all of the clicks, you're getting all of the immediacy of live theatrical performance. Now, they understand this completely within the world of jazz and, you know, increasingly in the world of popular music where you've got live albums. People, you know, are playing the whole album again, but live, because it's a different experience. And I think that's one of the glories of classical music and classical music concert programming, is that we get to see the intimate live performance and we get to see the intelligence. You watch people thinking as they're playing.
Ladies and gentlemen, our doors will close in 5 minutes. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium. Our doors will close in 5 minutes.
Kaviev was a fabulous chess player, and throughout his life, he was certainly involved, you know, in composition and great performance and so forth. But chess was a huge part of it. In the 30s and 40s, when he returned, I suppose, to the Soviet Union, one of the things he was very famous for, and could always draw a crowd, even if his works were were censored or frowned upon, the authorities, you know, recognized his brilliance at chess. And they would have, you know, big posters, you know, Prokofiev playing tonight. What, you think? Is it Symphony No. 1? Is it the classical? Or no, he was playing chess. And he played many people in chess. He even played a very famous violinist.
David Oistrakh.
David Oistrakh. huge chess player. In fact, one of the most famous chess tournaments or chess matches took place between Prokofiev and Oistrakh. And it was a very fragile affair. And there was a lot of backstory to it, which is always good for a good fight. And that and it kind of brings us back to the live performance element. There's a fantastic tale about Prokofiev. He was going along to see a performance of his own Violin Concerto No. 1 in 1927, and he's interested because there's this young, rather brilliant performer, 18-year-old David Oistrakh, mm-hmm. and so he sits down and the performance begins, and it's a live performance, not a recorded one. And he doesn't like it. He doesn't like it at all. And he's incensed at the way it's being pulled and pushed around by this young virtuoso. He stands up, screams at the top of his lungs, "That is not how you do it, young man. That is not You're how this is me. Done. No, I'm not." And they stop the performance. The composer is here. I suppose if he was here tonight and shouted, we might even stop it as well, you know? And that's the brilliance of live performance. So they shout and tell him to stop. So Prokofiev storms up onto the stage and, you know, stands right beside Oistrakh and then talks him through, note by note, how this thing is to go down. And then they recommence the performance.
A true masterclass.
A true masterclass. The brilliance of live performance. So anyway, they re-meet 10 years later. And they play chess. But this time, Oistrakh won. So he beat him comprehensively over a series of matches.
You know, Tomas, chess is it's a good analogy there because it has that contemplative, reflective character to it. And that's what's coming up here now, I think, in the second half.
I was thinking about that. Listening to it during the week, and again, coming up now, there's a huge moodiness to it. But there's also a very great calculation to it. And I'm thinking constantly about that great sacrifice, the huge sacrifice, and I don't think anyone could never fail to be moved by music from this era in Soviet history. And he was, it's the chess again, you see, he's thinking two steps ahead all the time. I was listening to his seventh during the week, and that's even a more interesting and moody piece again. And he was only a year away from death when he wrote that, couldn't have known that. But you can see how he's thinking about how his world will play out when he goes, but Stalin is left. And what I thought of when I was looking at the sixth again, when I was listening to the sixth, and there's even though it's very quiet and moody, there's a little glorious human element in it as well. And here maybe he was thinking 12 steps ahead. Because I think when you look back now, we're now reinterpreting it in this, you know, very personal and mood-driven element, rather than it being part of a production for the Soviet era sort of politics, which again, you had to be very careful as a Soviet composer. You had to make sure you were 19 steps ahead of the party because they were censoring people all the time. So I think he's outplayed Stalin. So he's thinking 12 steps ahead.
And he was ahead right until the very end, wasn't he?
Ooh, yes, I think I know it. Yeah, this is the death. This is the death.
Yes.
Yeah, he's supposed to have died on exactly the same day as Stalin, of course. And we know he died on the same day as Stalin's death was announced. I think that's what we would say now, because whenever they decided to tell him the world he was dead, and being dead is another matter. And so I can't help feeling he held on.
Until he heard the news. He probably became aware of it because he lived close to Red Square, and huge throngs of people were gathering once they heard the news of Stalin's death. And apparently for 3 days they couldn't get Prokofiev's body out of the house because of the crowds that were assembled. Now, is that not checkmate?
It's more like stalemate.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the final call. All doors are now closing, and we request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. Final call, ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing. Thank you.